Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we're going to be discussing a recent book by Dr. Douglas Bell. Doug is Professor of English Language Education in the School of Education and English and has worked in both the public and private educational sectors around the world.
Doug's been involved in various aspects of English and modern foreign language education since the 1980s and now specializes in the fields of English for academic and specific purposes. At UNNC, Doug serves as the director and admissions tutor for the MATSOL and the coordinator of postgraduate taught courses.
His book is titled Studying for a Master's in TESOL or Applied Linguistics, a Student Reference and Practical Guide, and is published this year by Routledge. So, Derek, I'm aware that this one is much more in your field than mine, so maybe you want to start off this discussion. How did you find Doug's book?
He sent it to me, in fact.
Did he?
I apologize. Full disclosure, first of all, I have taught on the MATSOL with Doug before.
So are you biased?
Totally biased.
Okay.
And so I've both been a teacher in this. I've supervised TESOL dissertations.
So big conflict of interest here.
Massive.
I'm not sure you should even be in this room.
I volunteer to leave if you wish me to.
I'll think about it. For now, stay where you are and continue the discussion, please.
Okay. So I found this actually a really interesting book, a much needed one, because I've seen students who come into the program, despite really well-scaffolded set of instructions, and in fact, a very rigorous entry requirement policy and interviewing and the rest of it, often really struggling with what it means to do this kind of applied teaching work.
Okay. What kind of a background do they come from into the MATSOL?
Depends. There's a few cohorts. We did one cohort of in-service teachers up in Beijing.
By in-service, you mean people who are already teaching, is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah. So okay. They're in the midst of teaching. Most of the people who come in wish to be teachers, may have some experience, but the ones on site tend to be a little more fresh-faced. So they tend to come out of an undergraduate program into the master's. But
okay.
We do get in-service teachers as
and
well.
And so basically they're teaching English as a foreign language. Okay, so to learners who want to speak English, basically, in their workplace, in their job. So are they native English speakers themselves or are they within China? I'm guessing they already have a very high level of English to be able to do this.
They do have high levels of English. There's a mix, right? So you can do an MATSOL if you're a native speaker and wish to upskill. So TESOL stands for Teaching English as a Second or Other Language.
Okay.
Right? So that's kind of the basis of it.
I understood from before it was always TEFL, so T-E-F-L. Has there been a big difference from this one, the movement of one acronym to another? By your face, I'm thinking that the answer is yes.
I'm actually not going to answer that because we have an expert in the room
who
can not only tell us about TESOL, TEFL, and EAP. So I wouldn't mind turning this towards Professor Douglas Bell.
Oh, what a coincidence.
Who knows more than me.
Here he is. Doug, could you please give us an overview of your new book, please?
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Derek. Yes, happily. So, my book, Studying for a Master's in TESOL or Applied Linguistics, a Practical Guide and Student Reference. Basically, the book is aimed at anybody who wants to do a master's in either of those subjects, either TESOL, an MATSOL, or an MA Applied Linguistics. And it's not primarily aimed at the students we have here. It's the worldwide market. It's anybody. And the book came about because I have felt for quite some time that there's a big gap in that particular market, in that particular literature. There's quite a lot of books have appeared over the last few years, which we might call study guides, you know, how to study XYZ, how to prepare yourself for blah, blah. But in my estimation, they've all been very general. Very often they don't differentiate between undergraduate and postgraduate. So without naming the names of the authors, there are some very good books out there that have become bestsellers. They're very good. They're study guides. They're university recognized. But I always felt that they, or still feel, that they fall short because of the lack of specificity, and they seem to assume that studying is this monolithic thing. And actually, of course, it's not. I mean, as we, I think all of us in the room today would agree on that, that, you know, studying a master's in TESOL is not the same as studying a master's in international business, or studying a master's in engineering, or whatever. All of these disciplines have their own vagaries, their own little quirks. So, long story short, I wanted to write a book that would prepare students for those degrees. And I wanted the book to be a mix, if you like, of study skills, but also using the content that they would encounter or will encounter when they actually join their degree. So they don't have to make that sort of big transfer that they do from the other books, you know, when they're learning the skills of effective reading and writing, effective note-taking, research skills, whatever it is that's one of the themes, you know, in a given chapter. They're learning that through the context of the material that they will encounter during an MA TESOL or MA Applied Linguistics.
That's great. We started jumping to you with the idea of maybe explaining how these different acronyms might work, some of the differences are between them. So maybe you could just give our listeners a quick overview of the kind of TESOL versus TEFL versus or ESOP.
Yeah, happily. I think the first thing to say about English language teaching, which is an acronym itself, ELT, is that it's an absolute minefield of acronyms, as Mary quite rightly pointed out at the beginning. Back in the day, so if I wind back 36 years to the start of my career, there was TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language, and there was TESOL, teaching English as a second language. And the difference between the two, I was trained in TEFL. So that was teaching people for whom English is a foreign language. So it would be going to somewhere like France or Spain or Poland, where people are learning, or Japan in my case, where people are learning the language as their foreign language. You know, they wouldn't usually use that language outside of the class. They wouldn't encounter it. It was a foreign language. So go TEFL. We could draw a distinction there between TESL, T-E-S-L, teaching English as a second language, which traditionally, back in the day, was practiced more in the States. You found that much more in North America because the demographics of the population there were such, still are such, that a lot of people would be learning English as a second language. So if you go onto the West Coast of America, I'm sure you both know a lot of people are native Spanish speakers. So most of their day-to-day life will be spent using Spanish, but they're in America, and to get a job, to interact, to study, they're going to need English. So in those cases, that's really English as a second language, not English as a first language, as a foreign language. So that was where the split was originally. TEFL on the one hand, TESOL on the other. And then over the years, and I don't know exactly when, but I would hazard probably something like about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, a new acronym came out, which was TESOL, which is teaching English to speakers of other languages. And that actually incorporates both TEFL and TESOL. The two are covered together in that one acronym, TESOL. So now you don't tend to find MAs in TEFL. I mean, you would have done 40 years ago. You'd have signed up for an MA in TEFL. You wouldn't see that now. Now it would be an MA TESOL, which covers both of those. Derek, you asked about some of the other acronyms, and I'd said that it's an acronym hell, minefield. I mean, we've got teaching English as a foreign language, okay, teaching English as a second language, now subsumed under TESOL. But within TESOL, within that sort of umbrella, there's loads and loads of other ways that we can slice and dice English language teaching. So, for example, we make a primary distinction between general English language teaching, general ELT, and English for specific purposes. English for specific purposes, in turn, can be split off into different strands. On the one hand, you've got EOP, which is English for occupational purposes, so English for jobs. And then on the other hand, you've got EAP, which is English for academic purposes. So if we look at just that split, you know, within ESP, English for specific purposes, you might have students who are learning English for their work, for their job. So it could be English for pilots, English for scuba divers, English for deep sea divers, whatever. But then on the other side, you've got people learning English for academic purposes. And these are students, obviously, who are coming into a university or some kind of institution for learning, and they need English for their studies. So you might get English for pilots that sits in the EOP realm because it's acting pilots who are using English in their job. You equally might get English for pilots in the EAP realm, because then you're training trainee pilots and they're using English to learn the language that they will use in the future. So it's quite complicated with these acronyms. And, you know, anyone familiar with the literature would see it's often split up into a tree diagram where you've got sort of English language teaching as the trunk, and then you've got all these branches that go off in different directions. And there's a whole host of other acronyms I could share with you, but I won't, because we'll be here all day.
Yeah. Thank you, Doug. So to get this right then, on the MA TESOL, are you actually teaching all of these different fields? Do the students that come to you, I mean, are they going out into the world and they're going to be teaching deep sea divers or school children or pilots?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good question.
That sounds really challenging.
Well, the way we structure the MA, it's an MA TESOL, so it's aimed at giving people a higher qualification in English language teaching. But the way we structure it, in the first semester, everyone does three core modules, which we believe will lay a foundation for any kind of teaching. But then when they get into the second semester, they choose electives. Their choice of those electives should really be determined by what they're interested in and what's relevant to their careers. So, for example, I'm module lead, I'm module convener for a module on EAP and ESP. So anybody who's thinking perhaps of, oh, I want to work in the university sector, or I want to work with, you know, the deep sea divers or whatever, as I facetiously mentioned, they would do my module, or they should do my module, because we'll look at the specifics that they need for ESP and EOP and EAP in that module. Another one of our electives looks at teaching young learners, which is another acronym, YL, TYL, teaching young learners, TEYL, teaching English to young learners. So if we have students, and we have actually quite a few who fall into this category, who want to become, say, primary school teachers here in China, it obviously makes a lot of sense for them to do the module on teaching young learners, because that's going to prepare them for that. So we have a module on testing and evaluation, for example, which cuts across all kinds of language teaching. But again, that's a kind of niche area all on its own within ELT. Some people would choose that elective because they want to work in testing. They want to work in IELTS or, you know, any of the other big tests.
Do the students who come to you, have they already had teaching experience? And I ask because I keep trying to remind myself that actually you're not teaching English, you're teaching people to teach English.
Yes, yes.
So you're teaching teachers, which sounds to me really like it will be really difficult.
It's not actually really difficult, but to answer your first question, at the moment I would say it's probably a 60-40 split across our student demographic, with 60% of them being people who haven't got teaching experience and 40% being who are experienced teachers of one type or another. In the ideal world, just a personal thing, I would prefer everybody on the course to be a teacher already, because if that were the case, we can assume a certain level of experience, a level of conceptual understanding, and it makes it a lot easier. And in fact, most MAs around the world do require that. The MAs I've worked on in other parts of the world, in the UK, in Australia, for example, the States, usually specify that all participants must have at least 2, in some cases 3, years of work experience before you could even get on an MA. Here at UNNC, we do things a bit differently in that we don't enforce that rule. We say that, yes, you could come onto the course with teaching experience, or you can come onto the course if you have a genuine interest in becoming an English teacher and you've done some studies in a background that's relevant. And as Derek had mentioned, I think at the moment, beginning of the interview, as part of our admissions process, we do screen applicants. We have a chat with them. We find out their motivations for doing the course. And as part of that interview, you know, I do most of those myself as the course director. We try to match people up and make sure that the course is a good match for them. So, you know, we do have a lot of students who come into the course who have zero teaching experience, but they think they might want to do this. They've been interested in English. They maybe did their BA in linguistics or English language, some variety, or education. Maybe they did an internship at a primary school somewhere, and they've got this idea that, hey, I might want to be an English teacher. So for them, the MA TESOL is the next step to getting qualified. It's a bit different for the ones who are already teachers. Those guys, that cohort, generally they're doing the MA because maybe they want to up their credentials. They want to increase their employability. They want to get a better job because most of the jobs nowadays are asking for a master's as a minimum. You know, the whole workplace in TESOL has changed massively in the 36 years of my career. In the way that I just mentioned about credentials, you know, it used to be the case. If I wind back, as I said, wind back 36 years, wind back to the 1980s, if you were a native English speaker, for example, back in those days, pretty much anybody could get a job teaching English. And that indeed happened. A lot of people, interestingly, quite a lot of people who are now big names in the field, by their own admission, started sort of backpacking the way around Asia or wherever, and they fell into English language teaching, got a taste for it, decided that they liked it, and then, okay, they got qualified and credentialed later on. But that's how it used to be. It hasn't been like that now for quite some time, which is a good thing, of course. It's professionalized. So now the pathways into TESOL as a career are actually quite well marked out. It's stipulated you must have, like any other profession, so you must have, first of all, an undergraduate degree of some kind. The next step after that, in the UK anyway, is typically to do postgrad certificate. There's a couple of postgrad certs out there. So most people will do their undergrad, they'll do a postgrad cert, certificate in TESOL. If they're serious about it, they'll then progress to doing either a postgrad dip or a master's or both. But the whole field has become much more credentialized, really. You know, you've got to tick these boxes now.
Sure. It really does feel, from listening to you talk about this, like this is a growing and very buoyant field, shall we say.
Multi-million dollar field.
Yeah. And that begs the question to me, it must be also crowded, and I think you mentioned this before, as regards the texts available. So why was your book so necessary?
Yeah, well, kind of like I think I said at the beginning, you know, I felt that the books that were out there were too generic. So I wanted to write a specific book targeting these particular people, these particular students. And when I did my literature search, when I first had the idea of the book, I couldn't find any, you know, quite honestly, I couldn't find any books that would tick that box. I mean, some would tick it in a small way. I mean, there are a couple of very good books actually out there that focus specifically on how to write a dissertation in TESOL, for example, or applied linguistics. One book in particular I'm thinking of by an Australian colleague is excellent. That's a very, very good book, and I would recommend that to my students. But that's only part of the MA journey. I wanted something that was going to cover the whole journey from A to Z and simplify it, make it absolutely, well, I hope, foolproof to say, right, you're going to do an MA TESOL from day one. What should you expect? What do you need to do? And not take anything for granted, because I think another weakness I would see of a lot of the study skills books, they do take a lot for granted. They assume that everybody just knows that you have to read.
Sure.
And that you have to cite a lot, you know.
This sort of connects to my next question, which is why did this gap exist? Why were these shortcomings there in the field? Because it seems, as you were saying, it's very, very buoyant. There are a lot of people interested in this, people going far and sort of big names and all the rest. So why do you think this gap existed that you have now filled?
I wouldn't say that I'm the only person who's ever going to fill this gap. There are some of the books I know that are in the pipeline at the moment. So maybe what I would say to you to answer your question there, Mary, is that I think people are starting to cotton on to the idea that there's this gap. But up to now, it hasn't really been filled. And that was my motivation, you know, 13 months ago for putting forward the proposal to Routledge to write this book. Interestingly, since then, I am aware of a couple of other books that are quite similar with other publishers that are also in chain. So mine's out in another week's time.
You always
time.
Find these books right at the end, just before you're about to publish as well,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, it's always the way it happens. But, you know, mine is about to go live. I was looking at it on Amazon this morning, actually. It's about to go live the week after next. And as I say, I do know from just knowing the field that there's a couple more with other publishers that are going to do not exactly the same, but complementary things. And I've been approached again by another publisher to say, oh, would you be interested in being involved in a second project? So it's evidently words got out and people are now starting to fill this gap, as I'd put it, yeah.
Well, we're very glad that you're keeping UNNC on the map as regards groundbreaking and trailblazing publications in TESOL.
So one of the unique features of both the MA TESOL program here and the book itself is the practitioner element. So having that in-class practice. Mm. Can you maybe describe that for the listeners so that they have a better idea of what that entails and sure. and how that's made relevant through the book? Mm.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And that's a good question, Derek. I think a failing of a lot of MA TESOLs around the world, and I've been involved in quite a few in the course of my career and MAs in applied linguistics, I think one of the failings is often that they're highly theoretical. They don't explicitly draw the links between theory and practice. In fact, most MA TESOLs don't include teaching practice. Ours does. And I would always say, have always said, that, you know, it's a USP, it's a unique selling point of our MA TESOL here at UNNC, that we do include teaching practice and we do, you know, observe our trainee teachers and give them feedback. We're always trying to make those links between theory and practice very explicit. And that's something, again, that I wanted to do in the book. So there is a chapter explicitly looking at teaching practice and what goes into that and teaching observations. So in the book, I talk about the whole process of observing teaching and the tools that people might use for that. I go into detail with a classroom observation tool that you know I've used over the years, and I give that as an example to try to raise people's awareness of what they would go through, what they need to be thinking about if they have this teaching practice component. So I guess it's a soapbox of my own, but right through everything I do with academia, but I always like to make these connections between theory and practice. I'm very keen on this idea, whatever I'm teaching, that there should be that link. You don't want to have something that's just up in the clouds. There has to be an applied point to it as well. And I'm always very keen to get my students to make that link. So
it always amazed me to kind of go back to your point about the old days of teaching English. We used to joke, I was one of these backpackers, I suppose. Not really, but we used to joke about all you needed was a degree and a pulse, and the degree was optional.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is making sure, I suppose, that in the upskilling, it's not only, again, like a theory, but being able to go into a classroom and do something effectively, but also being able to see and have that kind of reflective practice. One of the things that I've always enjoyed about the MA TESOL here, actually, is my fellow instructors and being able to watch them and learn from them on that program. So modeling behavior, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I think we do try to do that. It's this thing about connecting theory with practice. I mean, literally today, just before I came for this interview, I've been teaching on our core module, the language teaching methodology. And the purpose of that module is to raise the students' awareness of methodological developments in language teaching over the last 100 years. And we go through all the different ways that language teaching, particularly English language teaching, has been conceptualized and the theories it's been based on. But all the time I'm getting them, my students, to make connections with what they have experienced either as learners in the classroom or what they do as teachers and say, well, look, an alternative way of doing that. And I was saying to them this morning, as I often do, you know, that good, in my book, good teachers are thinking teachers. Nothing should just happen by chance. You should be able to justify and rationalize everything that you're doing in the classroom as a good teacher, as a language teacher. And you should be able to draw it back to the theories. You know, you should be able to say, well, yes, I've put them into groups there, or I've used pair work there, or I've done whatever based on this set of considerations. It didn't just happen willy-nilly. That's all been carefully thought out because I believe it's effective to do it in such a way. So getting that strong connection between theory and practice, I think, is really important. And with regard to my book, as I said a moment ago, I didn't want to leave anything for granted. Didn't want to take anything for granted. And I think a lot of the study books that I read, as I said before, they do take things for granted and they tend to give, I would say, fairly platitudinal advice. It'll be something like, oh, yes, in your studies, you will have to give an oral presentation. You need to be well prepared. Well, yeah, you know that.
Thanks for the advice.
I feel so reassured. Now I know. What have I been missing all these years? So I would take something like that and say, okay, yeah, you need to be well prepared. What does that mean? How do you prepare? And I will take the students in the chapter I wrote on oral presentations, take them through an A to Z to say, okay, here's your topic. Where do you begin? What do you do? Let's break it down step by step by step by step. So hopefully the claim on the book blurb, the cover, is that it demystifies the MAT Sol or Applied Linguistics journey. And I would hope it does do that, because it will absolutely unpack everything that they need to know, whether it's how to give an oral presentation, how to write a particular type of essay, how to write a linguistic analysis report, how to choose a good dissertation topic. These are all highly relevant things, I would say, that our students need to know how to do, but the existing literature tends to do it in a very generic way, you know, not specific.
Well, one of the contemporary problems we run into are, you know, the proliferation of ways to get at resources, for example. And, you know, it's so easy for a student to think, oh, I'll go on to Google Scholar. I'll plug in my keywords in some fashion, and then I'll get a list of, you know, 80,000 sources. And at no point in there is there a consideration of where they came from, or so enjoyed that part of the book, actually, where you went through in a very meticulous way and said, this is how you go into your library search function, and you make sure that if you're going to, you know, look for something, these are the kinds of search terms you should be doing, and reinforcing the fact that not all sources are created equal.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously you're familiar with that part of the book. I talk about a 3R formula, that sources should be recent, relevant, and reliable, and raising their awareness of that last one, reliable. I mean, you asked me a moment ago, Mary, what had changed in the field of TESOL. We could broaden that out and say, what's changed in academia? And I think one big change has been the absolute explosion of bogus journals, fake news, predatory journals, dodgy stuff. Certainly when I was a student, none of that existed, so I didn't have to worry about that, but the students now do. So they need those skills to be able to evaluate, well, is this actually a relevant source? Is it a reliable source? So part of the book does go into that, to saying, well, look critically at your sources. And this thing about being recent as well, that's something I've found over the years, been in the MAT Sol program director role now for 6 years. And something I notice, I have noticed over all those years, students, when they're finding the sources, tend to forget that they should be looking at stuff that's as recent as possible. So they'll be presenting material to me about methodology that was written in 1922 or something. And I'll have to point out, well, things have changed, guys, since 1922. You know, if this was a medical text, there's not much point in you presenting research on, you know, curing a headache with putting leeches on your head. Things have changed. And the same applies to TESOL. So to raise that awareness that, you know, you need to be looking at sources that are relevant, but also recent and that are reliable, that they're not these predatory journals, you know.
Must admit, I was a little bit heartbroken at your anecdote of the poor student who went into the library and was searching for sources and couldn't find any relevant ones because the poor woman was just looking at the shelves and so missed 80% of the holdings.
Yeah.
Whereas we'll admit that my student journey, we actually had the advantage that we could go into a university library and there would be sections dedicated to your field, including the journals. So you would, you know, be able to rely on the sources, but you could also find them by browsing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was mostly disappointed in that anecdote because I felt unnaturally aged from having read it. So.
Yeah. Well, what could I say? Tell me about it. I mean, that student, you know, it's an anecdote, but it's a true story. And I've had similar cases many times. Students come, and one this morning was telling me, saying, oh, there's nothing available on blah, blah. And of course, I express a very healthy skepticism. So I think you'll find there is. Where are you looking? And then you find out that they're just walking around the shelves kind of aimlessly. So again, it's not taking anything for granted. And I think in our particular context here at UNNC, it's really important that we don't take these things for granted, that the students who come to us, particularly if they've studied, you know, in some of the domestic Chinese universities for their undergraduate degrees, they might never have been taught those skills. So we can't assume that they know how to go into the library and use the library effectively. We just can't assume that. But it's always a challenge because of time. You know, we don't have enough time, any of us, in our courses to teach all the things that they need. Comment I often make to my MA students, I say, you know, by the time you graduate, I usually feel I've got you where I wanted you to be when you were first coming in. So we've just had the graduations last month, 50-odd students, happy students, all graduate, great day. I'm there shaking hands and you know, meeting parents. It's the best day of the year for me as the course director. But I always have a sort of a wistful sense as well, because I think, gosh, I've now got you where ideally I wanted you to be last September. If you could come in with that level of knowledge and skill in September, wow, you know, we would have done things very differently, but yeah.
Well, I would like to express empathy for all of these age-related difficult. But going back to what you were saying earlier about the sort of generic nature of the field, shall we say, of the books available in the field that exist, for you, you seem to be sort of favoring this kind of clarity and specificity. Mm. I was wondering, is this at all contested field? I mean, are there competing theories and competing pedagogies here? And if so, where does your book fit in between all of this?
Wow, a perceptive question for someone who doesn't work in TESOL. Is a contested field. I mean, TESOL perhaps isn't so much, but certainly the subfield of EAP is very much contested, English for Academic Purposes, because the theoretical bases that have informed the field, there isn't just one recognized theoretical base. There are many, and that part is contested. So how my book fits into that? I mean, this book is about TESOL. It's not about EAP. I've got another volume coming out on EAP, but I guess it's just raising awareness would be my simple answer to that. It's just trying to give students as wide an awareness as I can of what is out there. And as I said, giving them practical, hands-on, highly relevant content that they're going to encounter when they do their MA. That's really what my book's about. That's what this book's about.
Sure, sure. I didn't know EAP was so contested in that
yes.
way.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm suddenly opening a door here. That
kind of worms,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, that maybe we don't want to walk through, but can you give us some inkling as to what's behind it, perhaps?
Oh, gosh, yeah, I'm saying it's contested. Well, one thing, and this is actually bleeding out of self-promotion now, my second book that I'm hopefully publishing later this year. EAP is contested for various reasons. I mean, one difference, for example, between EAP and TESOL, I said earlier in the interview, TESOL, the routes into TESOL now, the qualifications you need, the pathways you go down are all very clearly marked. So what do I do to become a TESOL teacher? It's a fairly well-trodden path now. You do this, then you do this, then you do this. You know, it's very clear. If we look at EAP, that absolutely isn't the case. EAP is still the Wild West in that regard, that we've got some people who are qualified with masters, we've got some people who've got PhDs, we've got some people who've got postgraduate diplomas, we've got some people who've just been in the field long enough who have none of those things. It's still very unregulated, EAP. Now, it's improving, it's getting better, but it's still very wide open, and that's contested, right? I mean, there's some people who don't see a problem with that, some people do. I would be in the latter. I do see a problem with that because I'd like to have more tighter control over the professional standards, basically. I think there should be benchmarks and professional standards. It has been. There's been a movement in that direction, but in the case of EAP, again, something that's highly contested, is that in recent years, we've seen an influx of private providers into EAP. Now, this has been a massively contested area. So to give you an analogy, to put it into a different discipline, you know, imagine if over the next few years, suddenly the business school cease being taught by colleagues in the business school, it gets outsourced. Suddenly we've got a private company downtown Ningbo doing all of that at a cheaper rate with lesser qualifications. You know, this is highly contested, and we've seen this in not just the UK, actually. It's in Canada, it's in Australia, it's in New Zealand, all of the English-speaking world, this influx of private providers. Now, if I wind back, I did my PhD 2012, 2016. I think it was 2008, there was a publication, the first publication, to draw attention to this private provider phenomenon. And if memory serves, I think that author identified something like 16 partnerships between British universities and private providers where it outsourced their EAP work. That was in 2008. When I came along 8 years later, at the end of my PhD, 2016, that number of partnerships had jumped up from 16 to, I think I counted, 64. It's big business. EAP is linked with internationalization of universities, bringing in international students who pay higher fees. So the provision for that English language has become a worldwide big business. And there's half a dozen private provider educational companies that have cottoned on to that and have seen that this is a pretty good way to make money. And it's very attractive as well, I think, to the universities, because what typically the private providers do, they're big enough to say, well, we'll take care of all your English language training needs. We don't need office space. We don't need, you know, computers. We don't need pension plans. Leave all of that with us. And as a sweetener, we've also got a huge marketing network. We can bring in the international students for you. So we'll take away that pain as well. So this is typically what's happened. So this is why, I mean, money talks. This is why I think the number of partnerships has jumped up and is still jumping up. One of my MA TESOL graduate students a couple of years ago, he did his dissertation on an area that was touching on that, partly looking at that. And he'd counted the numbers have jumped up even more than you know, when I counted them. So this privatization of language teaching in universities is a massively contested issue. And it's problematic because it's taking EAP out of the academy. And for many, many years, those of us involved in that have been trying to keep it in the academy and to give it more prestige, more academic kudos, more standing. This boom in the private provision is pulling away from that massively.
So the privatization of it reduces the academic standard, in your opinion?
Yeah, oh, undoubtedly, because it reduces the academic standing. I mean, standards is a separate issue we could get into, but it reduces the academic standing, because typically the private providers would not require their EAP staff to do any scholarly work. There's no expectation of any research or publications. You're just a teacher. So it's sort of pile them high, get them in. I mean, to sound awfully cynical about it, and you know, some listeners might have a very different view, but I'm in quite a unique position, I think, on this, because in a lull in my career many years ago now, it's about, must be getting on for 20 years ago now, I actually worked for one of the private providers. So I've seen it from both sides. I've seen it working as a fairly senior manager inside a private educational company and as a head of school and professor and academic in the university system. And I know which I prefer, the university system, where English language provision is an academic endeavor. And you just tend to get a higher quality generally, partly because if it's in-house, those English language professionals can interface with the departments. You know, if I'm working as an EAP teacher, like here, for example, we have Seeley here, it is in-house. The Seeley staff are preparing students in the first year for what they're going to do in their second year. Those Seeley staff, those language teaching professionals, they can go and talk to us in the faculties anytime they like, and we can match the two up together. Imagine that if it was a private provider situation, you wouldn't have that. So it would all be, you know, a bit further removed. So you wouldn't get that link between the needs and preparing. So the standards, the qualities, you know,
yeah,
questions around that.
You're making quite a convincing argument as to how it is quite important to have that link. Seeley is, of course, the Centre for English Language Education.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all of our students who come in will first spend a year preparing for their studies.
Right. That's right.
With this department. And then they come on to us, of course. And yes, I agree with you that that link is very, very important. And I'm getting a really good kind of insight as to why. I've always sort of felt that I would take it for granted, perhaps. You know, now I'm realizing that universities would actually take that away in some circumstances. But also, this podcast is becoming very serious very quickly.
Well, the other side of this actually is that our Seeley staff are educational experts themselves. Mm. So they don't just teach EAP, they don't just teach general English, they also do teacher training of all sorts. Mm. So there's, you know, a lot more benefit potentially to having the in-house EAP provision, which goes beyond, you know, the EAP itself.
I mean, there's an argument, we're sort of moving in a way outside the original parameters of the podcast to talk about in my book on TESOL.
Oh, we love moving outside the original parameters. It's what to do.
Well, to move outside of those, I mean, I've been making an argument for some years now, and I'm not the first person to say it. Okay, it's not an original thought necessarily, but I've been making an argument that we should actually have EAP, if you want to call it that, for everybody at the university, not just for the international students. And a few years ago when I went to get my professorship and I went to Australia, that was one of the things that took me there. That was one of the you know, sweeteners that made me very interested, because in Australia, certainly the university I was working at then, they did offer EAP. They didn't call it EAP. They called it Academic Language and Learning, but same, same. They offered that to all students at the university. And I thought at the time, wow, that is an incredibly smart thing to do, because even as native English speakers, it doesn't mean that you know how to write an essay or that you know how to research in the library effectively or that you know how to give an oral presentation. We ourselves, right, had to learn all of those things kind of by trial and error, falling through the net. How much better it would be if you were taught that or you had access to someone who could teach you that at university. Now, Australia, that's fairly common. Academic literacies is right across the piece. So whether you are a native English speaker or a non-native English speaker, you will go through a diet of ALL in lots of the universities there. Certainly in my old university, that was the case. It's not yet the case in the UK. In the UK, EAP is typically only offered to international students or non-native English speaker students. So if you're a domestic student, if, say, me now studying in the UK, no, I wouldn't have the right to access any of that. And to me, that always seems like a major oversight. And to go back to this thing about the future of EAP being a little bit precarious because of this privatization, I've been arguing recently in some of my papers and this book that I'm writing that one way to offset that is to get EAP offered to everybody, to rebrand it in a sense and show that it's much more, as Derek said, there's other things, there's teacher training, we've got the PGCHE as well in universities. A lot of Seeley staff or Seeley type staff tend to be the ones who do that because they're the ones who've got expertise in teaching. So I think
that's the postgraduate certificate in higher education for listeners who don't know that acronym.
Thank you. Another acronym. But I think there's an opportunity there for EAP or language instruction in universities to reach a wider audience. And one of the benefits of that is that it would cement its role in the university. It would make its role much more definite. It would add more kudos, it would add more value. You know, at the moment, EAP tends to be the poor relation in universities. There's a two-tier system. If you're an academic, you come into a department, most junior rank teaching fellow, as you know, and then you'll go from teaching fellow, assistant professor, associate professor, full professor, if you're very lucky, up you go. That doesn't happen in EAP departments. EAP, you're a tutor or a senior tutor, a manager, and that's basically it. So it's a very different sort of career track, which, again, to go back to say, why are things contested? These are the reasons that make it contested. But if the fabric was changed and we had, as I said, an EAP centralized across the whole university, it could bring it under this standard academic framework.
So this is all your next book, right?
The next book, it's very soon next book. It's actually written. I'm working on the revisions.
Doug, you're on fire. How many books do you write every year?
Well, I will never do this again. I foolishly agreed to do two books last year. Actually, it wasn't a deliberate decision, I have to say. I got the contract back for the TESOL book, the one we started talking about. They got back to me first. So I was very happily working away on that. And then a proposal that I'd sent in a bit earlier, heard nothing about, suddenly came back from the other publisher and said, yeah, we'd like you to do this. And I said, all right, okay. And I didn't really want to do it. I'd be quite happy to say, well, can we put this on hold for at least a year? And then I thought, no, I might put them off if I do that. So I said, yes, okay. So last year I wrote two books, which I don't recommend anyone to do. Not if you want to have a life at the same time.
Okay, so book contracts are like buses,
yes,
basically. Yeah, they all come along at once when you
don't expect. I'm sure this tale is familiar to both of you as academics.
I do not want to talk about how many books I'm involved with right now.
Let's not even mention the journal articles, the book chapters, all of that, the presentations, the papers.
The podcasts.
But yes, in the new book, well, it's written, but the revisions, I'm making revisions after getting some feedback from the reviewers, the new book will go into all of this stuff about EAP because that's about EAP. It's a different book. The next book is Multilingual Matters, the publisher Channel Publications in the UK. Multilingual Matters by a different name. So, yeah.
So do we think this book is coming out? We got a preprint copy, so we were very lucky. But Are you expecting any of this controversy to spill over with this book, or is it just going to be widely embraced and everyone in TESOL and beyond will love it?
Well, let's hope for the latter. Let's hope for the latter. I don't see my TESOL book as being particularly contentious, because I'm not saying anything in there that's likely to upset the apple cart. If you ask me the same question about my EAP book, it's a different answer. That probably will upset a few apple carts and ruffle feathers, and I'll probably have death threats. So there's a few things in the second book that might shake it up, but they're different books. They're different audiences. They're different. They've got different purposes behind them, you know.
What intervention would you hope that your TESOL book does have?
Yeah. As I put in the preface, what I would hope is that it simply demystifies that TESOL journey for students. When I did my MA TESOL, well, I did an MA in TEIB, another acronym, T-E-I-B, Teaching English for International Business, many years ago. But when I did my MA, those sorts of books weren't out there. So I had to learn by trial and error, mostly error. Mostly falling through the holes in the net and finding out the hard way. So my wish for my book, and that was the driver for the book in the first place, is to give students a guide that's, you know, it's the next best thing as to having someone holding the hand with them while they're doing it, I think. And if they follow the instructions in the book, they'll be better prepared. So that's my wish. That's what I hope is the legacy of this book.
We hope so too. And you mention, of course, that you have another book coming out very quickly. But then can we ask you, what are your plans for the future after that? I'm guessing they involve having a very long rest.
I wish, but I don't think it's going to happen, because, like Derek was saying, I've got a backlog of all sorts of writing projects on the boil.
And can you share anything?
You can kind of become a victim of your own success, because having just written this book on TESOL, I was approached over the summer to be involved in another book on TESOL, similar but with a slightly different focus. So in that case, it's just a chapter, but I need to have that written by February. And then another publisher got in touch and asked again about something to do with TESOL, and I've sort of tentatively said yes to that. So a lot of writing projects are kind of stacking up above me, a bit like jumbo jets coming into land, and I'm sort of thinking, right, how can I manage my time to tick all of these off? And then there's other things that I'm just genuinely quite like to write. I mean, I gave a public professorial lecture this summer on Philip Larkin's poetry. That's just purely out of personal interest, nothing to do with my background as a professor of education. But I've got a couple of ideas that I'd like to expand that into articles. And that's just purely for personal interest. So
I like that visual image of jumbo jets coming in to land. So I've got pictures of like Doug on a runway in reflector gear, waving madly at all of these projects coming
towards
him.
Being squashed by the planes coming in. I'm sure you guys are the same. I mean, any academic I speak to nowadays, none of us ever seem to stop writing and publishing.
'Tis the life we chose, my friend.
It is.
Or is it the life that chose us?
Huh? I think on that note, we should say...
We're getting esoteric.
Thank you very much, Doug, for sharing your publication with us and your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a great conversation. Thanks.
It was. Thank you.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.